Yesterday I was reading Chakravarti Thakura to verses 30 and 31 of the ninth chapter, in which Krishna is revealing his inner feelings about his devotees. This is one of the great distinguishing features of bhakti yoga, that Krishna becomes purchased by the devotion of the devotee. Krishna actually becomes the property of his devotee. And their relationship is very deep and very intimate and extremely affectionate. So, first of all, that was shown in verse 22. We made the point that Krishna is prepared to even contradict the laws of karma as far as his devotees are concerned. And then 30 and 31 are explaining in a very vivid way that the devotee is so dear to Krishna that even if the devotee does something terrible, suduracha, extremely bad, or as Ramanujacharya says, exceedingly wicked. So this is really something quite extreme. This is not just making a small mistake or slipping up in some way. But even if the devotee does something extreme, extremely bad, but as long as the devotee remains ananya bhava, fully engaged in devotional service, then the devotee remains very dear to Krishna. In fact, Krishna helps the devotee to become rectified. And such a devotee who is basically sincere is quickly rectified. So anyway, we were describing the conversation between Krishna and Arjuna as described by Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakura, that Krishna was expressing himself very strongly. Arjuna was protesting that I can't accept it, that such a devotee would be considered a saint. I can't accept it. But Krishna was insisting, no, no, to the point that Krishna became angry. His eyes became red with anger. According to our acharyas, Krishna even said that if you don't accept this, I take it as an offense against myself if you don't accept what I'm saying. So then Arjuna sort of backed down a bit and said, all right, I'm prepared to accept it if you say so. But what about other people? How are they going to understand it? And then Krishna said that you take drums and kartals and you go and gather the people and you convince them. You tell them, Kanteya Pratijani. Now the question arises, why does Krishna say to Arjuna that you declare? Why doesn't Krishna say that I declare? Well, the reason for that is that Krishna, sometimes, he makes a promise and then he breaks his promise. Sometimes. Not that he's whimsical about it, like he's in the habit of doing it as a general practice. But sometimes, under certain important circumstances, Krishna does that. Like Krishna in the Battle of Kurukshetra, at the beginning he said, I won't fight. But when Arjuna was being threatened by Bhishma, then Krishna picked up the wheel of the chariot and he rushed towards Bhishma to kill him. But then the sun set right at that very instant. So Krishna didn't actually follow through with it and actually kill him. But he was going to do it. He was right in the middle of doing it. So Krishna breaks his word sometimes. Not whimsically though. Under what circumstances does Krishna break his word? If upholding his word means that his devotee is inconvenienced or things will go against his devotee, then Krishna will break his word. generally, of course, Krishna's word is truth. Just Krishna's desire is fact. But if anything actually interferes with the devotee, then Krishna's prepared to do anything, break his word, do something immoral. Because the highest standard of morality is that Krishna loves his devotee, and the devotee loves Krishna, and that exchange of love must go on. That is the highest principle of activity. So Krishna may break his word if it appears that upholding his word will adversely affect a devotee. But if the devotee gives his word that I say that Krishna's devotee, not I, but Arjuna, if Arjuna says that I say that Krishna's devotee will never perish, I give my word. Then if the devotee gives his word or her word, Krishna feels bound that I must uphold the word of my devotee. And if upholding the word of my devotee means that some other principle has to be broken, then I'll break that other principle. But my devotee's word will be upheld. So that's why Krishna says, Kanteya Pratichari. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur describes that Krishna is thinking that here I am, right in the middle of speaking Bhagavad Gita. And it's very important that people accept Bhagavad Gita and take it very seriously and then apply it. So if I now give my word in the middle of Bhagavad Gita, and just a little while later break my word, then they'll think, well, what is the value of this Bhagavad Gita? Krishna's saying so many things, but, you know, maybe what he's saying in Bhagavad Gita isn't true, because he breaks his promise. He made a promise right in the middle of Bhagavad Gita. But then he breaks his promise. So Krishna was thinking this may reflect badly on Bhagavad Gita. So therefore he didn't want to give him his own word. Although later on, in the 18th chapter, Krishna does take a type of a vow. He says that I'll deliver my devotees from their sinful reactions. So, now we go on to the last section, which is verses 32, 33, and 34. The idea here is that devotional service and the opportunity to reach the perfectional stage of devotional service is available to everyone. What to speak of Stri, Vaishya, Sudra, but even the Papa Yonis, Stri, Vaishya, Sudra, they're at least within Varnashram. But the Papa Yonis, that means those who are less, they're like untouchables. Kirata, Nandra, Pulinda, Pulkasha, Abira, Shumpa, Yavana, Kasadaya, Yenye, Chapapa, Yadapashraya, Shraya, Shudyanti, Tasmai, Padavishnave, Namaha. Even these categories, who are beneath Varnashram, they're not considered really part of human society, even, strictly speaking. But even then, if they take shelter of Krishna, they can also reach the supreme destination. So what to speak of the Vaishyas, what to speak of the Sudras, what to speak of women who are properly situated in Varnashram, they can certainly achieve the supreme destination. Even the dog eaters, Yavanas, Malechas. And in 33, Krishna makes the point that So obviously, the Brahmins and Kshatriyas, they can easily achieve perfection. It's no problem for them. They have great opportunity. And then in 34, he briefly describes the process that we should follow, that these people, these different classes of people should follow in order to achieve this goal of perfection of life. Manmana, we should always think of Krishna. Maya Sakta Mana, as Krishna said at the beginning of the 7th chapter. mind should be fixed on Krishna. Mad bhakta. Everything you do should be done as a service to Krishna. We should offer respect to Krishna. We should worship him. And if we're really absorbed and attached, absorbed in Krishna, attached to Krishna in these ways, then surely we'll come to him. Any of you not signed yourselves present? Just keep passing it around. So now we'll go on to the 10th chapter. The first section is verses 1 to 7. Now, it's interesting to note, in verse 1, Krishna says that I'm going to give you knowledge which is even better than what I've already explained. Now, we might think that how could Krishna give better knowledge? What we've heard is really quite extraordinary. But as we'll see, particularly in the Chatushloki Bhagavad Gita, verses 8, 9, 10, and 11, Krishna gives some knowledge which is even better than what we've heard so far. Quite extraordinary. So in verse 2, Krishna makes the point that even the greatest people in the material world can't understand him. The demigods and the great sages. There's no one greater than them in this material world. But even they can't understand him. Why? It's a very interesting reason he gives. Because he is their source. Now you might think, well, you know, why would that affect their understanding him? But if you think about it, you'll realize that if something comes from something else, like we have come from our parents, so actually it's very difficult for us to really understand our parents clearly. It's very difficult. And we can get some idea. But to really understand them very, very clearly is difficult. So this is the principle Krishna is referring to here. That if something is the source of something, then that thing which has come from that source finds it very difficult to really understand the source very clearly. So then Krishna goes on to elaborate on this. That if you know me as three things, Aja, unborn, Anadi, beginningless, and Loka Maheshwara. If you can understand me in these three ways, then you'll be liberated. And in fact, only this sort of person can really, truly be liberated. So, our acharyas give a very interesting analysis of these three terms, unborn, or these three concepts of being unborn, being beginningless, and being Loka Maheshwaram, or the controller of the universe. So, and this is in reference to the last verse in which Krishna is saying that the demigods and great sages can't understand him. So they point out that Lord Brahma is known also as Aja. That is one name of Lord Brahma. So Krishna is saying that I'm Aja. But Lord Brahma is also Aja. So what is the difference between Krishna and Lord Brahma then? They're both Aja. But Lord Brahma is not Anadi. He's not beginningless. And similarly, the great sages, the Maharishis, they're also known as being Aja, but they're not Anadi. But then, has anyone still not marked themselves present? So just keep on, as long as we get it back by the end of the program. So now there's a certain class of great sages who are called the Nityamukta Maharishis. They're also, they're Aja, unborn, and they're also known to be Anadi, beginningless. So how is Krishna different from them? Because he's Loka Maheshwara. He's the controller of all the worlds, of the whole universe, and they're not. Then the demigods, in general, they're Sarvaloka Maheshwara. They're controlling the whole universe. But they're not Aja. They're not unborn. and they're not beginning this. So the point is that Krishna is being distinguished very clearly from these other groups of people. And then even our acharyas say that some people say, as we heard in chapter 7, that Krishna is Brahman, and that Brahman has taken birth. If you remember, I think it's verse 24 of chapter 7. But Krishna says that he's Aja, he's unborn. So this concept of Krishna, if we're to say that Krishna and Brahman are the same, because Krishna is Aja, then this idea is shown to be invalid, that Krishna is Brahman, but the Brahman has taken birth, because Krishna is Aja, he doesn't take birth. And then even they go on to say that Krishna is distinguished from the Supersoul. The Supersoul is Aja, Anadi, and Loka Maheshwara. But now there's a difference, and this is a little more, it's not really mentioned here specifically. But in one sense, Krishna is not Aja. He's not unborn, because he takes birth as the son of Devaki or the son of Mother Yasoda. So in this way, Krishna is distinguished from the demigods, the Maharishis, Brahman, and even Paramatma. So if we understand Krishna, Bhagavan, Krishna says, Ma, Yo Ma, Ajam Anadim Cha. If you understand me, this means Krishna is Bhagavan. In my unique position, then you can be liberated. And our acharyas say that this verse fulfills the statement made in chapter 4, verse 9. Who can remember what is chapter 4, verse 9? Any of the Matajis? Mataji? Right. Janma karma chame divya. That Krishna's appearance and activities are transcendental. And if you understand that, then you won't take birth again, but you'll go to Krishna. So this verse fulfills that particular verse. In verses 4 and 5, a number of important qualities are mentioned. We won't go through them all. Our acharyas explain that Krishna is mentioning all these very, well, most of them are good qualities, but anyway, all these different qualities and things, for the same reason, that just as the demigods and sages can't understand me, so also you cannot understand me simply through having these qualities, because these qualities are coming from me also. So they won't really help you to understand me. So we might ask, how are we going to understand Krishna? Which is a very good question. And the answer, it's not actually stated here, it's stated a little later on. Only by Krishna's mercy, or the mercy of his devotees, which in a sense is the same thing. But not independently. Not because you're a big, powerful demigod. Not because you're a big, liberated sage. Not because you're Brahman realized. Not because you're Paramatma realized. But only by Krishna's mercy, or the mercy of those who already have Krishna's mercy. And then again, verse 6 mentions some more important people. The 7 great sages, then the 4 other great sages, that's the 4 Kamas, even the Manus, they're also coming from Krishna. So why mention them? Because they also can't understand Krishna unless Krishna reveals himself, or he is revealed to them by the mercy of Krishna's devotees. But then in verse 7, Krishna makes the point that if you do understand me, if you get at least a reasonable understanding of me, of course we can't understand Krishna totally, it's not possible. But at least if we get some reasonable understanding of Krishna, then we become convinced that yes, Krishna is so great, we have some faith in Krishna, and then as Krishna says here, then you'll engage in devotional service. Prabhupada said that religion without philosophy is just a sentiment. So you may think, oh, I love Krishna. Krishna's so great. But if you don't understand Krishna and how Krishna's working, how his energies are working, then you may think, oh, Krishna's very nice. But when Maya attacks you, your faith in Krishna will be very easily shaken. So to have this understanding of Krishna is very, very important. So now we go on to the second section, which is verses 8 to 11. This is called the Chatushloki Bhagavad Gita, or the entire message of Bhagavad Gita in four verses. Bhagavad Gita in a nutshell. Saracharyas give some very nice explanations about these verses. First of all, verse 8. Krishna is saying, Aham Sarvasya Prabhava. I'm the source of everything. The spiritual worlds and material worlds, Prabhupada mentions in the verse, in the translation. But it's not only that. Our acharyas explain that this includes Brahman, Paramatma, the whole Vaikuntha realm, all the avatars, everything, whatever exists, Krishna is including here. That every single thing in existence comes from me. And if you understand this nicely, Buddha, then you'll engage in unalloyed devotional service, bhava samanvita. This term bhava is used because bhava is the stage just next to love of God, just before love of God. So you can achieve that level. Then in verse 9, Krishna explains the activities of those devotees who have understood him and who have engaged in devotional service, or who are engaging in devotional service on the basis of that understanding. They're always thinking of him. They're always dedicated to serving him. And they're very happy to discuss about him, to hear and chant about him together. So, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur gives a nice commentary. He says, their minds become, he's speaking as Krishna, their minds become completely eager to hear my names and pastimes. Their life airs have come to me. Without me, they cannot maintain their lives. This is their food. And Baladev Vijayabhushan says, they cannot live without Krishna. Just like fish out of water, they feel desperate to be in Krishna consciousness. He says, it's as if they become lusty to hear about Krishna. So, you know, you can just get some idea of how intense their attachment to Krishna is. That they must hear about Krishna. They just cannot do without it. So as Bhaktivinoda Thakura says, Kabe habe bolo se dinama. When, oh, when will that day be mine? When will that day be ours? That we'll have this fierce desire that we must be Krishna conscious. And if there's something which is trying to interfere, then we feel terribly disturbed. So it's like that. He says that tusyanti cha ramanti cha. They experience, they derive great satisfaction and bliss. Tusyanti means satisfaction, ramanti means bliss. So Baladev Vijayabhushan says that tusyanti, satisfaction, is the result which the devotee who is practicing Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti experiences. If you're practicing Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti, everything is going very nicely, your mind is relatively under control, circumstances are favorable, you're getting absorbed in Krishna consciousness somewhat, then you experience satisfaction. Whereas Ramante, bliss, ecstasy, refers to those who are practicing Raganuga Sadhana Bhakti, spontaneous practicing spontaneous devotional service, following in the footsteps of the inhabitants of Vrindavan, they become ecstatic, blissful, overwhelmed with bliss. So verse 10, to those who are constantly devoted to serving me with love, I give the understanding by which they can come to me. In the purport, Srila Prabhupada is mainly explaining this verse in terms of a person who is either illiterate or perhaps physically removed from the association of devotees, so therefore doesn't really have access to so much information about Krishna. That at least if that person is sincere, then Krishna will reveal everything. Prabhupada says in the third paragraph, a person may have a bona fide spiritual master and may be attached to a spiritual organization, but still, if he's not intelligent enough to make progress, then Krishna from within gives him instructions so that he may ultimately come to him without difficulty. And the same idea is there, Prabhupada explains the next verse, verse 11, basically in the same way, mainly, although in the last paragraph of the purport to verse 11, Prabhupada also introduces a somewhat higher concept, that is of Krishna revealing himself to the devotee and bringing the devotee to the level of perfection, entering into their eternal relationship with Krishna. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur makes some very interesting comments on these two verses. This is really like this most confidential knowledge which Krishna is referring to. He says that in verse 10, the devotee is described as being bhajatam priti purvakam, engaging in devotional service with love. Priti means love. In other words, prema. This devotee is on the level of prema. Now, if the devotee is on the level of prema, then what is the question of buddhi yoga? Generally, the term buddhi yoga refers to karma yoga. You're using your intelligence. So now why, he raises the question, why does Krishna use this term, buddhi yoga? What is this buddhi? Because the devotee is already so advanced, extremely perfect, actually, basically perfect. So what is the question of some buddhi yoga, which is more or less like a lower concept? So, he says that Arjuna asks, in between 9 and 10, so the devotees are practicing like this, but how do they enter into their personal relationship with you? And then Krishna speaks, verse 10. He says, I give them the inspiration within their hearts. It doesn't come from within themselves. In other words, it's not coming from them. It doesn't come from within themselves. It doesn't come from any other source. It only comes from me. And it can only be accepted by them. Then they come into my direct association. So this buddhi yoga is this inspiration. It is me. It is my personal association. So he's explaining that what Krishna is saying is that this buddhi yoga which Krishna gives the devotee who's on the level of prema is that he reveals himself, he reveals their eternal relationship with them, and then he allows them to enter into their eternal relationship with him. So this is like the most confidential knowledge, how one ultimately enters into one's eternal relationship with Krishna. And then Krishna speaks verse 11. So Vishnu, or both of our acharyas, I took bits and pieces from both of their purports, they say that Krishna says, for these devotees I give by my mercy a special type of knowledge. Of course, that knowledge is mainly knowledge of their eternal relationship with him.